Marta Botero y Andrés Barbosa. Desde Sydney.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Welcome, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. This is Back in the USSR, Rebel Music Radio here on CFRU 93.3 FM, and I, Siegfried, have returned. It's been 10 months. I was in China for the second time, teaching English in the world's largest socialist country. And as we go on, I'm sure I'll get plenty of chances to talk about my experiences, but for now, I'd like to read you a quote. It's thousands of years old. Their anger. Thousands of years old is their bitterness. I am only returning their scattered words with rhyme and rhythm, and you fear that I am spreading fire. That poem is called Spreading Fire by Gorakh Pandey, a revolutionary Indian poet of the 20th century. And that's what this show is all about. Back in the USSR is all about spreading fire, inflaming the hearts of working-class people with their own history and culture around the world. Getting them in touch with the roots of the modern struggle against imperialism, capitalism, and everything that these oppressive, exploitative forces stand for. From sexism to racism to colonial genocide, real socialism struggles against all of these things, and I'm proud to say that Back in the USSR has a small role to play in this global struggle for justice and liberation. Now this show, seeing I haven't been here for 10 months, is going to cover a lot of ground. We'll talk about Cuba, Syria, Venezuela, and all the nonsense going on with the US and Russia. But I'd like to start here in Canada. I've been away for quite a while, and there is a massive amount of things I need to cover, but fortunately I came back on July 3rd, so I missed all the national chauvinist colonial propaganda hoopla surrounding Canada's 150th birthday celebrations and all the nonsense that happened around that. I mean, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I'll celebrate this country after it decolonizes and not a moment before. One of the things I taught my students in China was about the colonial conquest of North America, and our vocabulary for that lesson included words like settler and reservation. It was my duty to talk about these very real things if I wanted to do my job and teach real history to Chinese students looking to go to Canada and the US for university, which is what the university, what the international school I worked at was all about. It was all about sending Chinese students, preparing Chinese high school students to go study abroad. So I ended up talking about real history, about the real anti-colonial resistance by indigenous peoples in this country. Even talking about the Oka crisis of 1990, close to its actual 27th anniversary, where the Mohawk Nation faced off against the Canadian Army in defense of their land. Something most Canadians know nothing about. Safe to say, I myself was lucky when I was in high school, because I actually was taught about that in civics class, but the only reason I got taught about it in civics class was because it was an Indigenous man leading the civics class. Safe to say, a colonial society built on land theft and the genocide of Indigenous peoples and nations is nothing to celebrate. This country needs revolutionary change. So I'd like to start the show with a song in tribute to a man, a hero of Indigenous resistance in Western Canada, who I taught my Chinese students about and actually tested them on their knowledge of, and who all Canadians should learn one hell of a lot more about. This is for Louis Riel. Listen to Back in USSR here on CFRU 93.3 FM. And that was Eric Voice, Canadian Indigenous artist, with the song Louis Riel. Now, I, of course, am Siegfried, and I want to do a personal tribute here on the show tonight. There was one thing I was very regretful of when I was away, 12 time zones away, actually. I mean, that's how far China is away in relation to Eastern Standard Time and whatnot. And unfortunately, last November, I did miss the funeral of someone who was very, very important to me. I would almost call him a second father, actually, given the kind of importance he had in my life. And this, of course, was a man who was a professor at the University of Guelph. His name was Fred Eidlin, and professor of political science, who I worked with. I did an undergraduate thesis with him. I did a graduate thesis with him. He was the one who basically facilitated the whole, the first time I really went abroad in went to another country in a meaningful way in 2008 when I went to Russia for a semester abroad in Moscow. He was the one who facilitated that. And really, he was, what I really want to pay tribute to here tonight is really his courage. This man, I mean, he opened my eyes to a lot of things. He was a man who constantly was questioning, constantly exploring the world, constantly just did not take things as a given, did not go on assumptions. He did not take things for granted. What he did is he asked questions. He really explored. He really analyzed things. And I would like to think, at least in the things I do, I carry on in his footsteps in a lot of ways. Certainly I learned quite a lot. I mean, he didn't let me get away with anything. I mean, that's the way it was, why some people found it very frustrating to work with him, because he wouldn't let you get away with anything. He really interrogated you on why you were interested in a particular subject. Like, why was this interesting? Why is this important? Should people care about this? Why is this, worthy of his time, my time? This kind of stuff. Like, what makes this so interesting? What's the problem here that's so important that needs to be solved? And that's really what he really, I guess, drummed into me, like, in the time I worked with him. Fred Eidlin, one of the things that I thought, one of the reasons why I found himself so courageous, but besides, being a questioner, actually being in academia and having to deal with that environment and dealing with the repression that goes on in academia against people who rock the boat, as he sometimes did over the course of his career, in the name of basically of truth and whatnot, he was willing to ask questions beginning in the McCarthyite period in the 1950s. When, of course, Russia and everything having to do with Russia was being demonized like crazy in the United States and North America and the West in general. He, of course, grew up at that time. I mean, his parents were actually Russian. And that certainly was one of the reasons that motivated him to actually ask those first tough questions, like when he was growing up, and basically say, my parents are Russian. And, they spoke some Russian at home when I was a kid and this sort of stuff. And these are the people who gave birth to me and stuff. And okay. And then they're saying they're talking all this trash about Russia and Russia's, Reds are under your bed and you should be really afraid of Russians and communists and all this sort of stuff. And be really afraid of them. And it's this sounds strange. I mean, what's going on here? I mean, I guess, because it hit really close to home for him. And he started asking those questions. And by the time the 1960s rolled around, I mean, he had gone to Europe. After he was done his undergrad, he'd gone to Europe. He became fluent in German and in French. He lived there in Europe. And the first chance he got, he actually went to places socialist Czechoslovakia, socialist East Germany, and eventually to the USSR itself. And he actually saw what they were really like. He broke through the propaganda and went there himself and actually explored himself and asked questions himself, actually interacted with these people, learned the language, and lived among the people there. I mean, that's what he did. And so he gained insights that lion's share of people do not get about these societies and about these ideologies that are so regularly demonized and continue to be demonized to this day in places like Canada. So he was really something else. And it takes a certain amount of, it takes a certain kind of courage to be able to do that. And that's really want to pay tribute tonight to him. And so, Fred, I'm sorry I couldn't be at your funeral. I'm sorry I couldn't be there. I was, you know, being 12 time zones away, couldn't be there at the last, you know, last moment. But I mean, what is there to say except that I continue to walk in many ways in your footsteps. So I would like to play a song for this very, very brave man who had such an influence on my life. And this is a song called In Cythera by the band Killing Joke. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Those who are
okay, listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Killing Joke with In Cythera, and I don't think Fred Eidlin would have exactly understood so much about that song, seeing like he didn't really listen to much post-1970. But, you know, I think he gets the message if he you know, this sort of thing. But anyway, that was in tribute to him, my mentor in many ways. And, well, there's one more thing I really want to read kind of in tribute to him. And that was it's a quote from a book I'm reading right now called The 900 Days about the Siege of Leningrad in the Second World War. And after the Second World War, in a brief essay called About What I Thought During the Days and Nights of the Leningrad Blockade, the creator of the Hermitage, you know, the big art collection that's in Leningrad, you know, St. Petersburg today, the creator of the Hermitage, Orbeli, at that time, he had this to say about his own teacher, Sergei Zebelev, who died during the siege in December of 1941, when, of course, Leningrad was holding out against the Nazi siege that was imposed on it. And he said about his teacher, you know, talk of his words, of all the thoughts which he then shared with me, of the great strength of the spirit of a man who, in the course of his whole life, fulfilled his duty unswervingly, the duty of a scholar, a teacher, and a citizen. I think that also applies to Fred as well. Now, I do actually want to give another eulogy here tonight, and the next piece, which I'm going to play, is actually all about this. And that is for the victims of the Grenfell Tower disaster in the UK from a few months ago. And this, of course, we still don't know the full death toll of that in London, where, of course, this whole tower, low income residences just went up in flames. Could potentially be, dozens, maybe even hundreds of victims. And they were victims of austerity, these working class people living there. There were no fire escapes. There weren't enough stairways. The entire outside of the building was coated in flammable material that just went up like a torch. There were no sprinkler systems. I mean, these people were sacrificed. These working class people were sacrificed by capitalism, basically. Which didn't want to provide adequate safety, wanted to cut costs, maximize profits. And one of the things I encountered around that time was this poem by Ben Okri. He read this poem on Channel 4, actually, in the UK. And this is his poem, which is about a 10-minute poem. It's rather long, but it's just the most powerful thing I've seen about this particular tragedy. This crime, really, against working class people in the UK. And really, this show is, once again, an internationalist show. So we talk about the things that go on in other countries and express solidarity with the people there in their struggles for justice and for liberation. And this is a part of that. So this is the poem that Ben Okri wrote and performed for the victims of the Grenfell Tower disaster in June. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Grenfell Tower, June 2017. It was like a burnt matchbox in the sky. It was black and long and burnt in the sky. You saw it through the flowering stump of trees. You saw it beyond the ochre spire of the church. You saw it in the tears of those who survived. You saw it through the rage of those who survived. You saw it past the posters of those who had burnt to ashes. You saw it past the posters of those who jumped to their deaths. You saw it through the TV images of flames through windows running up the aluminium cladding. You saw it in print images of flames bursting out from the roof. You heard it in the voices loud in the streets. You heard it in the cries in the air howling for justice. You heard it in the pubs, the streets, the basements, the digs. You heard it in the wailing of women and the silent scream of orphans wandering the streets. You saw it in your baby who couldn't sleep at night, spooked by the ghosts that wander the area still trying to escape the fires that came at them black and choking. You saw it in your dreams of the dead asking if living had no meaning, being poor in a land where the poor die in flames without warning. But when you saw it with your eyes, it seemed that what the eyes saw did not make sense, cannot make sense, will not make sense. You saw it there in the sky, tall and black and burnt. You counted the windows and counted the floors. You saw the sickly yellow of the half-burnt cladding. And what you saw could only be seen in nightmare. Like a war zone come to the depths of a fashionable borough, like a war zone planted here in the city. To see with the eyes that which one only sees in nightmares turns the day to night, turns the world upside down. Those who were living now are dead. Those who were breathing are from the living earth fled. If you want to see how the poor die, come to Grenfell Tower. See the tower and let a world-changing dream flower. Residents of the area call it the crematorium. It has revealed the undercurrents of our age. The poor who thought voting for the rich would save them. The poor who believed all the papers said. The poor who listened with their fears. The poor who lived in their rooms and dreams for their kids. The poor are you and I. You in your garden of flowers, in your house of books, who gaze from afar at a destiny that draws near with another name. Sometimes it takes an image to wake up a nation from its secret shame. And here it is every name of someone burnt to death, on the stairs or in their room, who had no idea what they died for or how they were betrayed. They did not die when they died. Their deaths happened long before. It happened in the minds of people who never saw them. It happened in the profit margins. It happened in the laws. They died because money could be saved and made. Those who are living now are dead. Those who are breathing are from the living earth fled. If you want to see how the poor die, come see Grenfell Tower. See the tower and let a world-changing dream flower. They call the tower ugly. They named it an eyesore. All around, the beautiful people in their beautiful houses didn't want the ugly tower to ruin their house prices. 10 million was spent to encase the tower in cladding. Had it ever been tested before except on this eyesore? Had it ever been tested for a fire, been tried in a blaze? But it made the tower look pretty. Yes, it made the tower look pretty. But in 24 stories, not a single sprinkler. In 24 stories, not a single alarm that worked. In 24 stories, not a single fire escape. Only a single stairwell designed in hell, waiting for an inferno. That's the story of our times. Make it pretty on the outside, but a death trap on the inside. Make the hollow sound nice. Make the empty look nice. That's all they will see, how it looks, how it sounds, not how it really is on scene. But if you really look, you can see it. If you really listen, you can hear it. You've got to look beneath the cladding. There's cladding everywhere. Political cladding, economic cladding, intellectual cladding. Things that look good but have no center, have no heart, only moral padding. They say the words, but the words are hollow. They make the gestures, but the gestures are shallow. Their bodies come to the burnt tower, but their souls don't follow. Those who were living are now dead. Those who were breathing are from the living earth fled. If you want to see how the poor die, come to Grenfell Tower. See the tower and let a world-changing deed flower. The voices here must speak for the dead. Speak for the dead. Speak for the dead. See their pictures line the walls. Poverty is its own color, its own race. They were Muslim and Christian, black and white, and colors in between. They were young and old and beautiful and middle-aged. There were girls in their best dresses with hearts open to the future. There was an old man with his grandchildren. There was Amaya Tuku, 3 years old, burnt to ashes before she could see the lies of the world. There were names who were living beings who dreamt of fame or contentment or education or love, who are now ashes in a burnt-out shell of cynicism. There were two Italians, lovely and young, who in the inferno were on their mobile phone to friends while the smoke of prophets suffocated their voices. There was a baby thrown from many stories high by a mother who knew otherwise he would die. There were those who jumped from their windows and those who died because they were told to stay in their burning rooms. There was a little girl on fire, seen diving out from the 20th floor. Need I say more? Those who are living are now dead. Those who were breathing are from the living earth, fled. If you want to see how the poor die, come see Grenfell Tower. See the tower and let a world-changing deed flower. Always there's that discrepancy between what happens and what we're told. The official figures were stuck at 30. Truth in the world is rarer than gold. Bodies brought out in the dark, bodies still in the dark. Dark the smoke, dark the head. Those who were living are now dead. And while the tower flamed, they were tripping over bodies at the stairs because it was pitch black. And those that survived sleep like refugees on the floor of a sports center. And like creatures scared of the dark, a figure from on high flits by, speaking to the police and brave firefighters, but avoiding the victims whose hearts must be brimming with dread. Those who were breathing are from the living earth fled. But if you go to Grenfell Tower, if you can pull yourselves from your tennis games and your perfect dinners, if you go there while the black skeleton of that living tower still stands unreal in the air, a warning to similar towers to fear, you will breathe the air thick with grief, with women spontaneously weeping, and children wandering around stunned, and men secretly wiping a tear from the eye, and people unbelieving staring at this sinister form in the sky. You will see the trees with their leaves green and clean, and will inhale the incense meant to clean the air of unhappiness. You will see banks of flowers and white paper walls sobbing with words, and candles burning for the blessing of the dead. You will see the true meaning of community. Food shared and stories told and volunteers everywhere. You will breathe the air of incinerators mixed with the essence of flower. If you want to see how the poor die, come see Grenfell Tower. Make sense of these figures, if you will, for the spirit lives where truth cannot kill. 10 million spent on the falsely clad in a fire where hundreds lost all they had. 5 million offered in relief ought to make a nation alter its belief. An image gives life and an image kills. The heart reveals itself beyond political skills. In this age of austerity, the poor die for others' prosperity. Nurseries and libraries fade from the land. A strange time is shaping on the strand. A sword of fate hangs over the deafness of power. See the tower and let a world-changing thought flower.
Listen to Back in USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Ben Oakry's poem about Grenfell Tower. Back in USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
For the second year, Frontier College Guelph will be running Guelph Exploration Club, a fun, free day camp for new immigrant and Arabic-speaking children ages 6 to 12. This dual-language club aims to help new Canadian children improve their literacy in English, prepare for the upcoming school year, and make new friends. The club runs July 31st to August 4th, 8:30 to 4:30 at Gateway Public School, 33 Gateway Drive in Guelph. We are physically accessible and free. You can contact Erica Woodford at Frontier College for more information at ewoodford@frontiercollege.ca. You can also find us on Facebook, Frontier College Guelph, or just Google Guelph Exploration Club for our registration page. Hope to see you there.
Lead your ears astray with Oral Tethers, Friday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight, with your host, Hymns 57. Delving into field recordings, found sound, avant-garde, experimental, electronic, and otherworldly soundscapes designed to lead your ears astray, only on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I want to change gears a little bit and talk about one thing that's really increasingly in the headlines of the world right now. And that, of course, is what's going on in Venezuela, which, of course, I was following the entire time I was in China and with increasing concern. And I think I found a pretty decent article which sums up really what's going on. And that is an article by the PSL, Party of Socialism and Liberation. And this is what they put out on July 21st, 2017. It's called Venezuela at the Crossroads. And of course, Venezuela, I mean, huge progressive gains have been won there over the last few decades since the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998. And really, those progressive gains are what's under fire right now. So the article goes like this. In a significant escalation of the ongoing political crisis in Venezuela, the hard right opposition held an illegal plebiscite on July 16. On the ballot was, among other things, a resolution to stage a military coup against President Nicolas Maduro. This election was less than representative and had many irregularities. Many voters were observed voting multiple times in multiple locations, and there was no electronic or even analog system to place in place to prevent this. The plebiscite was not even conducted through the country's National Electoral Council. Duplicate social media posts from right-wing accounts claiming to originate from far different locations showed the exact same image of voters participating. The alleged turnout of 8 million for a phony plebiscite has been proven mathematically impossible given the number of polling locations and the duration they were open. And eyewitnesses on the ground reported paltry turnouts to polling places. The opposition claimed that all ballots would be burned after tallying for fear of alleged government repression. In reality, this was a measure that allowed the opposition to claim whatever results they wanted to. No third-party verification possible. The background of this plebiscite is ongoing nightly violence in the form of the Guarimbas, a Chavista name for far-right protests, which have endured for months and have seen the lynching of government supporting Chavistas, Afro-Venezuelan citizens being doused in gasoline and burned alive by opposition supporters, the use of homemade rockets and improvised explosive devices against the government, police, and military forces loyal to the Bolivarian Revolution, and attacks on state-run food distribution centers and medical facilities. This opposition movement has now called for a general strike as part of their ongoing zero-hour plan to create chaos for ordinary Venezuelans and delegitimize the democratically elected United Socialist Party of Venezuela, PSOV, government. So far, the military and Bolivarian Revolution-aligned police forces have been remarkably restrained, patient, and disciplined in their responses to the chaotic street violence. Government officials, who could have shut down the unconstitutional opposition plebiscite by force, instead permitted it to take place largely unmolested. But the opposition is dedicated to escalating matters as far as possible to try and achieve their goal of harming the revolutionary government. If the opposition's general strike goes forward, becomes violent, and faces repression from government forces, whose side should socialist supporters of democracy support? In the United States, large-scale protest movements are associated with progressive causes and efforts. This creates an opening for the forces of U.S. imperialism who are able to manipulate this general impression that protests are progressive by projecting a distorted image of protests to create popular support in the United States for regime change in other countries. However, in a world of billions, the ability to mobilize large numbers alone is rarely the end of the story. A deeper understanding of the forces at play is always crucial, and the current situation in Venezuela is no different. In Venezuela, the opposition is principally backed by the business sector, including most of the largest businesses and private media conglomerates. And the ranks of the protest movement are principally made up of those from the more affluent sections of society. Central to the opposition's stated plans is the goal to privatize and sell off the 1.7 million new public housing units built over the last dozen years or so, and significantly roll back the entire range of social programs that have reduced poverty and increased living standards for the majority of the country. The opposition's plans should be seen in context of the legislative coup government in Brazil and the anti-peace deal campaign in Colombia as part of a broader right-wing push to roll back the social gains made by the working class, indigenous, and Afro-descended populations in Latin America under various left-leaning governments over the past 2.5 decades. On the other side of the Chavista forces, including some forces of the Venezuelan state, who are defending the gains of the Bolivarian Revolution for ordinary poor and working class citizens. These, among other things, include significant increases in food security, the expansion of healthcare to the entirety of the population at little to no cost, the elimination of illiteracy, and the expansion of social rights for indigenous and Afro-Venezuelan populations. These gains also include the institutions created by the grassroots, known as communes, that are pioneering socialist-oriented ways of organizing the people's way of life. Contrary to the opposition's claims, the Chavista movement is conducting a truly democratic constituent assembly process to rewrite the Constitution to decisively address the structural issues behind the current economic and political crisis. This is a process that almost certainly will involve millions of people. Tens of thousands have clearly been participating in the selection of candidates. Large marches of people, of hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans, have taken place several times over the past few months to support and push forward this process and to oppose the right-wing protests. On the same day as the opposition plebiscite, the government held a dry run for the Constituent Assembly, which saw a very strong turnout with long lines in the mostly working-class strongholds of the Chavista movement. This process is not simply a rubber stamp of the Maduro government, as the opposition alleges. In fact, it has seen a significant amount of discussion at the grassroots in general, and more specifically among socialist and communist activists who are the backbone of the overall Venezuelan movement towards socialism. The assembly process is representative of the broad range of support the government has pulled together, including some renegade sections of the capitalist class. This has created a lively discussion about the future of the country, most notably how to move beyond capitalism and the relevant state structures and economic organization that would be required. On a related note is the debate on how hard of a line to take against the business sector and their capital strike that has so crippled the country. Some argue for a more direct and aggressive moves to see a socialist society, taking lessons from previous and current socialist experiments. Others would like to see a more broad-based conciliation between various social and political forces across classes to try to end the current crisis. These debates over the direction are real and substantive, not simply an issue of narrowly endorsing Nicolas Maduro as president. Venezuela is at a crossroads. Since about 2004, Venezuela has been trying to create a balanced developmental social program, socialist government governing experiments, and worker self-management of enterprises with a capitalist market economy. This uneasy coexistence was bound to break down with a downturn in the oil economy. Considering the role of the oil economy as principal driver of economic activity and government spending. What is happening in Venezuela now is not protesters against the state. Society there is now breaking into two camps. One camp wants to return to the pre-Chavez status quo by dismantling social programs that have improved the standard of living. That coalition is made up of those who benefited the most from the previous highly unequal society. The other camp seeks to maintain the social gains of the past couple of decades and to move to further consolidate them by bringing government structures into line with a people-centered, not a profit-centered society. In other words, the society is divided along class lines. The majority of those in the owning class and those who benefit the most from their rule are in the former camp, while the majority of the working class and other oppressed populations are in the latter. The actions of both sides have to be judged on that basis. If the opposition succeeds, it means the return of extreme wealth inequality, ultra-high poverty rates, mass homelessness, and housing insecurity, the reduction of access to comprehensive health care and education, and the destruction of community and workplace-level experiments in socialism. Progressive people in the United States, then, have a dog in this fight. If one truly supports comprehensive universal health care, education, housing, and food as human rights, then supporting the Venezuelan Revolution and its next step, a constituent assembly, is the obvious choice. So that was from the Party of Socialism and Liberation. Now, Venezuela, of course, is an isolated case. I mean, there's struggle, of course, all around the world by, you know, where progressive forces are trying to defend the gains that have been won. You can see that everywhere. You can see that in the current struggle in Syria, which I'm going to talk about later. But of course, you can see that all over Latin America now. You know, of course, right-wing governments have come to power recently in places like Argentina and Brazil and rolled back progressive gains in both those countries, with catastrophic results for ordinary people. You know, and enforced austerity on them and this sort of thing. So that's really what the people of Venezuela are up against right now. Well, they're up against basically right-wing fascism, basically, that wants to destroy everything they've created, everything they've built over the last few decades, all the progressive changes that they've made. You know, the right-wing forces in Venezuela want to tear all that down so that they can have exclusive control and reap massive profits from the exploitation of the people. That's really what's going on in Venezuela right now. And that has to be understood. And so here, of course, I'm back in the USSR. We support the Bolivarian Revolution here. And we defend the current government of Venezuela as it struggles to move towards socialism in that country. And the forces behind that government as well, as they move towards the Constituent Assembly, which will be voted in on July 30th to rewrite the Constitution in a progressive direction. That is something that every working class person, frankly, in the North or in the South, in North or South America, should get behind and support and cut through all the propaganda you get on the mainstream media about, you know, all the nonsense about the government cracking down on peaceful protesters. It isn't like that. These right-wing forces in Venezuela, they will target schools, they will target military bases, they will target media centers, government subsidized healthcare facilities. They will target all these areas, all these things. They will attack and they will kill people. They will lynch black people in the streets, douse people in gasoline, all kinds of things. The kind of right-wing terrorism going on in Venezuela right now has claimed 100 lives, and surely will claim more before these guys are stopped and shut down hard. As all fascists should be shut down hard, anywhere they are. So I'm going to play some music, some revolutionary music from Latin America, and it's going to be some diverse stuff, because not only am I going to play some stuff about Venezuela, I'm also going to play a tribute to Fidel Castro, of course, has died over the course of the last 10 months, and I want to pay tribute to him, of course, a revolutionary hero and a symbol, not only for people in Latin America, but around the world who are fighting for change and for socialism. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Pongo por delante de nosotros al comandante de de todos los comandantes, al Cristo Redentor, crucificado y resucitado, al Cristo y su mensaje liberador, al Cristo y su mensaje de amor, de la justicia social. Y los llamo a todos, los que quieran patria, vengan conmigo para que sigamos haciendo patria.
Socialismo, inclusión, solidaridad y vocación, sacrificio, integración, reimpulsando la nación, justicia y revolución, son una misma cuestión. Como el pueblo y el amor, invencible voz de Dios, un compromiso, un corazón.
Socialista Unido de Venezuela, un partido para elevar a su más alta dimensión la patria de Bolívar.
PSV, la fuerza de los pueblos. PSV, la fuerza de los pobres. PSV, de hombres y mujeres. PSV, de los trabajadores. PSV, América Latina. PSV, alerta que camina.
Campesinos, transportistas, militares y milicias, policías y bomberos, comerciantes, misioneros, petroleros, petroquímicos, científicos y obreros, enfermeras y doctores, creadores, pescadores,
profesores, estudiantes, barrenderos, navegantes, peluqueros, carpinteros, afroindios, vigilantes, sacerdotes, periodistas, zapateros, los apuntes, batallones, brigadistas, vengan, cooperativistas.
PSV, la fuerza de los pueblos. PSV, la fuerza de los pobres. PSV, de hombres y mujeres. PSV, de los trabajadores.
Socialismo, solidaridad, unidad, unidad, la diversidad, victoria de Venezuela, paz, prosperidad, salud, seguridad, unidad latinoamericana, victoria, victoria, victoria de Venezuela.
Del PSV con Chávez, vamos a vencer, militantes del PSV con Chávez, vamos a vencer, militantes del PSV con Chávez. ¡O muerte! ¡Venceremos!
Tendría que ser un son pie con pie, mano con mano. ¿Cómo se le habla a un hermano? Si me quieres, aquí estoy. ¿Qué más te puedo ofrecer? Sino continuar tu ejemplo. Si quiere conocer a Martí y a Fidel,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
Si quiere conocer los caminos del Che,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
Si quiere tomar ron pero sin Coca-Cola,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
Si quiere trabajar en la caña de azúcar,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
En un barquito se va al vaivén,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
Si quiere conocer a Martí y a Fidel,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
Si quiere conocer a Martí y a Fidel,
a Cuba iré.
Si quiere conocer los caminos del Che,
a Cuba iré.
Si quiere tomar ron pero sin Coca-Cola,